a centimetre or two.
Why were you on Hubris?
I wasn't. Who says I was?
Take your pick. Simon Croats? Namba Wilk?
Don't know them. You've got the wrong man, you miserable bastard. Now frag off!
Murdin Eichlone, then. What about him? Didn't he hire you? That brought the nod at last. An imperceptible motion of his head. The crewman beside me lunged out of his seat, a compact shock flail snapping out of his sleeve and into his gloved hand.
Drop it,
I willed, without even speaking. The flail sparked as it bounced off the tabletop. It was in my hand a second later. I whipped it back across its owner's face and smashed him sideways off his chair. Then I snapped it round, crushed the left ear of the other crewman, and laid him full length on the floor at the foot of the table. I sat back down, facing Tanacbray, the flail in my hand, his face grey, and his eyes darted now with panic.
Eichlone, tell me about him.
His left arm moved inside his jacket, and I jabbed the flail into his shoulder. Unfortunately, I realized he was wearing armor under that silk. He reeled from the impact, but his arm came up all the same, a short-snouted las pistol clutched in his fist. I slammed the table into him, and his shot went wild, punching through the back of a nearby ruffian. The victim toppled over, bringing another table smashing down. Now the shot and the commotion had got the attention of the entire tavern. There was general shouting and confusion. I didn't pay it any heed. Tanacbray fired again through the overturned table, and I dove aside, colliding with milling bodies. The merchant was on his feet, kicking and punching his way through the mob to the exit. I could see Betancourt, but the mass of bodies prevented him from blocking Tanacbray.
"Aside!"
I yelled, and the crowd parted like hatch shutters. Tanacbray was on the walkway outside, running for the key at the end of the street. He turned and fired. Pedestrians screamed and ran. Someone was pushed into the canal. Tanacbray leapt into a grav skiff, shot the protesting hire driver, pushed the corpse off the steering perch, and gunned the craft away down the canal. Betancourt's air bike was sat on its kickstand to my left. I cranked the power and swept off down the waterway in pursuit.
"Wait, wait!"
I heard Betancourt yelling.
"No time."
Tanacbray's flight caused mayhem down the length of the busy canal. He drove his skiff into the jostling traffic, forcing craft to heave out of his way. Already the decorative golden filigree on the skiff's black hull was grazed and dented with a dozen glancing impacts. People on the banks and abroad on the water howled and yelled at him as he wrenched his way through. Where the street met a canal thoroughfare, he tried to extend his lead with a surge of speed. A fast-moving courier boat coming down the stream veered at the last moment and struck the quayside with great force, sending the craft up over end, its hull shredding, its driver cartwheeling through the air. I laced the air bike through the disrupted traffic in Tanacbray's wake. I wanted to gain height and move to a level where I could coax more speed from the machine without fear of collision. But the vehicle's grav plate had a governor unit that prevented anything more than 3 meters of climb. I had no time to figure out where the governor was or how to disable it. I aimed the bike between turning skiffs, water buses heavy in the choppy canal, other darting air bikes. Ahead, I could hear the distant sounds of military bands. Tanacbray whipped out of a junction into the Grand Canal and straight into the side of the afternoon's parade. A slow-moving river of skiffs, military barges, and landspeeder escorts filled the entire width of the waterway. The craft were full of jubilant Imperial Guardsmen and officers, thundering regimental bands and battle fleet dignitaries. The air was glittering with streamers and banners, company standards, Imperial Eagles, and Gudrunite Cardinons. One entire barge bore a massive golden Carnadon sculpture to which whooping guardsmen clung. Garlands fluttered from the barrels of 1,000 brandished las rifles. The walkways and bridges of the Grand Canal were choked with cheering civilians. Tanacbray's skiff smacked into the side of a troop barge, and angry yells and jeers were loosed at him as he tried to turn. From the shore, the crowd pelted him with fruit, stones, and other missiles. Cursing back at the angry soldiers, he slammed his skiff round the rear of the barge, trying to force his way across the canal. I was closing on him now, trying to avoid the displeasure of the mob. Hooters and sirens bayed at him from the parade boats as he jostled across their paths. A trooper from one barge leapt onto his skiff to waylay him, and Tanacbray kicked him off into the water before he could get a good footing. That turned things even uglier. The noise of the booing and outrage was immense. The parade bunched up badly, and dozens of furious guardsmen pressed at the rails of their barges, trying to reach him. He over-revved the skiff to get clear of them, and struck against a raft carrying a company band. Several instrument players toppled with the impact, and the proud imperial anthem they had been playing dissolved in a cacophony of wrong notes and broken rhythms. Enraged troopers in a smaller skiff drew alongside him and rocked his craft dangerously as they tried to board. He pulled his handgun, his last mistake. I pulled up short and landed on the canal bank. There was no point in pressing the pursuit now. Tannock Bray got off 2 shots into the mob. Then 20 or more freshly issued las rifles on a neighbouring barge opened fire, smashing him and his stolen craft to pieces. The drive unit exploded, scattering hull fragments across the churning water. A curl of black smoke rose above the banners. The young conscripts of the 50th Gudronite Rifles had made the first kill of their military careers. Chapter 10. A Conflict of Jurisdiction. The House of Glore. Stalking Secrets. Long after midnight, I was attempting to sleep in my bedchamber at the Dorset Regency. Beckwin and Amos had both retired to their own rooms hours before. Reflected light from the canal outside played a series of silver ripples across the ceiling of my twilit chamber.
Aegis Rosethorn!
Bettencourt's voxed whisper suddenly tapped at my ear. Rosethorn, reveal.
Spectres, invasive, spiral vine.
I was already out of bed and into my breeches and boots, pulling my leather coat over my bare torso. I went out into the apartment lounge with my power sword in my hand. The lights were off, but canal reflections played in here too, creating a fluttering half-light. Bettencourt stood by the far wall, a needle pistol in each hand. He nodded at the main door. They were good, and they were very quiet, but we could both see slight movement against the cracks around the doors, backlit by the hall light. A gentle vibration of the handle told me someone was springing the lock. Bettencourt and I dropped back against the walls either side of the doors. We closed our eyes and covered our ears. Any forcing of the door would trigger the deterrent charges, and we didn't want to wind up blind or deaf. The door opened a crack. No flash charges roared. Our visitors had detected and neutralized the security countermeasures. They were even better than I first thought. A slender telescopic rod extended smoothly in through the crack. An optical sensor on the end slowly began to pan around, searching the room. With a nod to Bettencourt, I moved forward, took hold of the rod and yanked hard. At the same moment, I ignited my power sword. A body crashed into the doors, dragged forward by my hefty pull on the spy stick, and came tumbling in. I leapt in to straddle the body, but despite his surprise, he writhed away with a curse and threw a punch. I had a vague impression of a tall, thickly built man in form-fitting leather. We flopped over together, wrestling, overturning a couch and knocking down a candle-stand. My opponent had a good grip on the wrist of my sword-arm, so I punched him in the throat with my left hand. He collapsed, retching, onto the floor. I got him in time to hear a strong voice say, "Put the weapons down now!" A short, hunched figure stood in the open doorway. Bettencourt had both pistols trained on it, but was slowly lowering them, despite himself. The figure had used the will. I brushed the tingle aside, but it was too much for Midas. The needle pistols thumped onto the carpet. "Now, you," the figure said, turning its silhouette towards me, "disarm that power blade." I seldom had an opportunity to feel the effect of psycho-manipulation. The technique was different from the ones I employed, and the force of will was unmistakably potent. I braced myself for the hideous strain of outright telepathic combat.
"You resist," said the figure.
A blade of mental energy stabbed into my skull, rocking me backwards. I knew at once I was fundamentally outclassed. This was an old, powerful, practiced mind. A second stab of pain, cutting into the first. The man I had left choking was now on his knees. Another psyker. More powerful than the first, it seemed, but with far less control or technique. His attack seared through my skull and made me bark out in pain. But I blocked him as I stumbled back and stung his eager mind away with a desperate, unfocused jab. The boiling psychic waves were rattling the windows and vibrating the furniture. Glasses shattered and Bettencourt fell, whimpering. The hunched figure stepped forward again and dropped me to my knees with renewed mental assaults. I felt blood spurt from my nose. My vision swam. My grip on the sword remained tight. Abruptly, it stopped. Roused by the disturbance, both Amos and Bequin had burst into the room. Bequin screamed. Her psychic blankness, abruptly intruding on the telepathic maelstrom, suddenly blew the energies out, like a vacuum snuffing the heart of a fire. The hunched figure cried out and stumbled in surprise. I drove forward, grabbed him, and hurled him bodily across the chamber. He seemed frail but surprisingly heavy for such a small mass. Betancourt recovered his weapons and lit the lamps. The man I had pulled through the doors was little more than a youth, big built with a long, shaved skull and a slit of a mouth. He was crumpled by the windows, semi-conscious. He wore a black leather body glove adorned with equipment harnesses. Bequin relieved him of his holstered sidearm. The other, the hunched figure, rose slowly and painfully, ancient limbs cracking and protesting. He wore long, dark robes. His thin hands were clad in black satin gloves. A number of gaudy rings protruded from the folds of the gown. He pulled back his cowl. He was very old. His weathered, lined face wizened like a fruit stone. His throat, exposed at the gown's neckline, betrayed traces of the augmetic work that undoubtedly encased his age-twisted body. His eyes blazed at me from their deep sockets with cold fury.
"You have made a mistake," he said, wheezing. "A fatal one, I have no doubt."
He produced a chunky amulet and held it up. The sigil it bore was unmistakable.
"I am Inquisitor Commodus Volk."
I smiled. "Well met, brother," I said. Commodus Volk stared at my rosette for a few lingering seconds, then looked away. I could feel the psychic throbbing of his rage.
"We have a conflict of jurisdiction," he managed to say, straightening his robes.
His assistant, now back on his feet, stood in the corner of the chamber and gazed sullenly at me. "Then let us resolve it," I offered. "Explain to me why you invade my apartments in the dead of night."
"My work brought me to Gudrun 8 months ago. An ongoing investigation, a complex matter. A rogue trader had come to my attention, one Efrys Tanakbre. I had begun to close my net around him when he was scared into flight and got himself killed. Simple cross-checking revealed that a grain merchant called Farcheval had somehow been instrumental in that incident."
"Farcheval is my cover here on Gudrun."
"You see fit to play-act and hide your true nature," he said scornfully.
"We each have our methods, Inquisitor," I replied. I'd never met the great Commodus Volk before, but his reputation preceded him. An intractable Puritan in his ethic, almost leading to the hard line of the mono-dominance, but for the fact of his remarkable psychic abilities. I believe something of a Thorian doctrine suited his beliefs. He had served as a novitiate with the legendary Absalom Angevin 300 years before, and since then had played a key role in some of the most thorough and relentless purges in sector history. His methods were open and direct. Stealth, cooperation, and subterfuge were distasteful concepts to him. He used the full force of his status and the fear it generated to go where he pleased and demand anything of anyone to achieve his goals. In my experience, the heavy-handed, terror-inspiring approach closes as many doors as it smashes open. Frankly, it didn't surprise me to learn he had already been on this planet for a full 8 months. He looked at me as if I was something he had almost stepped in.
"I am discomforted when I see Inquisitors holding to the soft, cunning ways of the Radical. That way heresy lies, Eisenhorn."
That made me start. I consider myself, as I have reported, very much of the puritanical outlook. Staunch, hard line in my own way, though flexible enough to get the job done efficiently. Yet here was Volk, gauging me as a Radical. And at that moment, next to him, I felt I may as well be the most extreme, dangerous Horusian, the most artful and scheming recongregator. I tried to push past that. "We need to share more information, Inquisitor. I'll take a guess and say your investigation somehow involves the Glore family." Volk said nothing and showed no response, but I felt his assistant tense psychically behind me. "Our work is indeed clashing," I went on. "I, too, am interested in House Glore." In short, simple terms, I laid out the matter of Eichlone's activities on Hubris, and drew the connection to Glore and Gudrun by way of the mysterious Pontius. I had his interest now.
Pontius is just a name, Eisenhorn. Pontius Glore, on the other hand, is long dead. I served with worthy Angevin in the purge that destroyed him. I saw his corpse.
Yet here you are, investigating the Glores anyway. He exhaled slowly, as if making his mind up.
After Pontius Glore's eradication, the House of Glore made great efforts to distance itself from his heresy. But Angevin, rest his immortal soul, always suspected that the taint ran deeper, and that the family was not free of corruption. It is an ancient house, and powerful. It is difficult to probe its secrets. But from time to time, over the past 200 years, I have turned my eye to them. 15 months ago, prosecuting a coven on Seda 7, I uncovered traces which suggested that particular coven and several other minor groups were collectively being run by an all-but-invisible parent cult, a cult of great scope and power, old and hidden, stretching across many worlds. Some traces led to Gudrun. That Gudrun is the Glore's ancestral home was, for me, too much of a coincidence.
"Now we make progress," I said, sitting down in a high-backed chair and putting on a shirt Beckwin brought to me from my chamber. Amos poured 6 glasses of Amasek from a decanter on the dresser. Taking one as it was offered, Voke sat down opposite me. He sipped contemplatively. His assistant refused the glass that Amos offered and remained standing.
"Sit down, Haldane," Voke said. "We have things to learn here."
The assistant took a glass and sat in the corner. "I hunt out a cabal, controlled by a notorious facilitator," I continued, "a cabal set on performing an abominable crime. The trail leads to Gudrun and the Glores. You do the same with another heretical cell."
3 others, in fact," he corrected.
3, then. "And you see the shape of a far greater organization. From the facts as they stand, we are both approaching the same evil from opposite sides." He licked his lips with a tiny, pallid tongue and nodded.
"Since coming to Gudrun, I have rooted out and burned 2 heretical cells. I am reasonably sure of the activities of another 9, 3 here in Dorset alone. I have allowed them to fester as I observe them. For months they have seemed bent on preparation for some event. Abruptly, a matter of weeks ago, their behavior changed. This would have been around the same time as your confrontation on Hubris."
"Eichlone's undertaking was also great, with extensive preparatory work. Yet at the 11th hour something either went wrong or plans were suddenly changed. Though I defeated and destroyed him, his plans were really thwarted by the fact that the Pontius didn't arrive. What has your work revealed of House Glore?"
"I have visited them 2 times in 3 months. On both occasions they have made every effort to answer my questions, allowing me to search the estate and their records. I have found nothing."
"I fear perhaps that is because they knew they were dealing with an inquisitor. Tomorrow, Sire Farcheville has a trade meeting with the Glores at their estate." He mused on this.
"The Inquisition has a duty to stand together, firmly, against the arch-enemies of mankind. In the spirit of cooperation, I will wait and see what your dubious methods reveal. Precious little, I imagine."
"In the spirit of cooperation, Voke, I will share all I learn with you."
"You will do better than that. The Glores know me, but not all of my students. Haldane will go with you."
"I don't think so."
"I insist. I will not have years of work ruined by another agency such as yourself running roughshod through the matter. I require my own observer on the ground, or my cooperation will not be extended."
He had me in a vice, and he knew it. To refuse outright would simply confirm my radical, careless approach in his eyes, and I had no wish to draw battle lines against another of the Inquisition, especially a man as powerful and influential as Commodus Voke. "Then he had better do exactly as I instruct him," I said. We left Dorset for the Glore Estates the next afternoon at 4. Dressed once more as wealthy but not ostentatious merchants, Beckwin and I were accompanied by Amos, Betancourt, and Haldane, Voke's man. Haldane, I was pleased to see, had made a reasonable job of adopting simple civilian dress. He and Betancourt would pose as our bodyguard and escort, and Amos was to take the part of a gene biologist. Machelis and 4 other luxuriously robed envoys from the regal bonded merchant guild of Synesius were waiting for us at the guild headquarters. An atmospheric launch had been prepared. The launch, a burnished dart bearing the guild crest, left the landing platform of the guild building's roof and rose smoothly into the overcast sky. It was, Machelis informed us, to be a 2-hour flight. A guild envoy circulated through the richly furnished cabin with trays of refreshment. Machelis explained our itinerary. A formal dinner with the representatives of House Glor that evening, an overnight stay, and then a tour of the estates the following morning. After that, negotiations, if both parties were still interested. We flew west, inland, leaving the inclement coastal weather behind, and passing into a sunlit landscape of rolling pasture, low hills, and maintained forests. The snaking silver line of the Druna winked below us. There were occasional small settlements, farmsteads, a compact market town with a tall ecclesiarchy spire. Once in a while, we saw another air vehicle in the distance. A dark range of hills began to fill the western skyline. Evening was beginning to discolour the clouds. The region approaching the hills rose in bluffs and headlands, a more majestic and wild landscape, thickly wooded on escarpments and deep vales. Already, Machelis boasted, we were flying over Glor property. The estate itself loomed out of the dimming hills some minutes later. A 3-story main house, built in the neo-Gothic style, dominating a bluff and staring down across the deep valley from 100 window eyes. The lime-washed stone glowed lambently in the twilight. Adjoining the main structure were substantial wings built at different times. One led to stables and other considerable stone outbuildings along the edge of the woodland, and I presumed this to be the servants' block. The other wing edged the crown of the bluff and was dominated by a dome that shone gold in the sinking sun. The place was huge, and no doubt labyrinthine. The population of a modest town could have been accommodated within it. The launch settled onto a wide stone yard behind the house. At the edge of the yard, in what looked like converted coach houses, 3 other launches were stationed in hangars with well-equipped maintenance bays. We disembarked into the yard. The air was cold, and a night breeze was bringing spots of rain with it. The wind sighed in the stands of trees beyond the house. Heavy bars of cloud laced the evening sky above the towering hills. Servants in dark green liveries hurried out to us, taking up our luggage and raising wide, long-handled parasols to shield us from the drizzle. A number of uniformed guards from the Glor's house retinue flanked the yard. Haughty and confident in their long emerald storm coats and plumed silver helmets, the guards seemed like experienced veterans to my eyes. The servants escorted us and the guild envoys into an atrium with a black and white tiled floor and a bright, silvery cast to the light. Dozens of vast crystal chandeliers hung from the high, arched roof. More guards flanked the doorways. The Glor's militia was clearly sizable. "Welcome to the House of Glor," a woman's voice said. She approached us, a well-made woman of good high stock, her powdered face bearing the proud insouciance of all nobility. She wore a regal black gown, floor-length and wide in the skirt, and laced with a silver overstitching, and a great twin-cusped headdress of black mesh and pearls that tied under her chin with a wide black ribbon. Machelis and the envoys bowed ceremoniously, and the 5 of us made more conservative nods. "The Lady Fabrina Glor," announced Machelis. She approached, green-coated servants forming a human wake behind her. "Lady," I said.
"Sire Farchival, I am so pleased to meet you."
She gave us a brief tour of the main house. I have seldom seen such extravagance and riches outside of an imperial court, or Tobias Maxilla's staterooms. Lean hunting dogs trotted with us. She pointed out a number of ancient paintings, mostly oil portraits, but some exquisite hololithic works, as well as vivid psych-picked miniatures. Her illustrious family, uncles, grandfathers, cousins, matriarchs, warlords. Here was Vernal Glor in the dress uniform of the House Militia. Here was Orkees Glor, entertaining the Royal House of Sameter. Over there, Lutine and Gyves Glor, brothers at the hunt. There, great Oberon himself, in the robes of an imperial commander, one hand resting on an antique globe of Gudrun. The envoys made appropriate noises of admiration. Fabrina herself seemed to be just going through the motions. She was acting the hostess. We were, after all, just grain merchants. This was a duty, an obligation. I saw Amos making surreptitious notes. I too made careful observations, especially of the house geography. In one long hallway, the stone floor was dressed by the rather worn pelts of three carnadons, skinned, spread-eagled, their massive tusked mouths and baleful eyes frozen in attitudes of rage. Even in this sad state, the size and power of these creatures spoke for themselves.
"We hunted them, but there are few left now," Fabrina Glore remarked, offhand, seeing my interest. "Old times long past. Life was rather more feudal then. Today House Glore looks entirely to the future."
At dinner, in the massive banqueting hall, we were joined by Uricel Glore, the commander of the House Militia, and his eldest brother, Oberon, the current Lord Glore. But the dinner was not solely in our honour. A cousin of the Glore family and his entourage were visiting from off-world, as were several other trade delegations and a wealthy shipmaster called Gorgone Locke. I was not surprised. Visiting grain traders, even ones accompanied by the prestigious Guild Synesius, hardly merited a formal banquet. It was appropriate we should be honoured by our inclusion at a larger event. No doubt we were meant to be impressed. I attended with Bequin and Amos. There was no place for servants and bodyguards here, so Betancourt and Haldane had been escorted to our suite and food provided for them there. That suited my approach fine. There were five long tables in the hall, laden with roast meat, fruit, and countless delicacies. Attentive butlers and serving staff moved everywhere, offering platters and topping up glasses. Stern members of the House Militia, in green and brocade dress uniforms and polished silver helmets, stood at every corner of the chamber. We were on the third table, with a contingent of livestock merchants from Gallinate, a city on Gudrun's southern continent. Our status afforded us the company of Lady Fabrina, Captain Terence from the Household Guard, and a talkative man called Cowitz, a House Glore official responsible for buying produce. Lord Oberon and his brother Uricel presided over the head table, with their visiting cousin, the shipmaster Locke, and an elderly ecclesiarch called Datso. Cowitz was happy to tell me that Ecclesiarch Datso represented a missionary order from the subsector Edgeworld Damask, which House Glore was sponsoring. In fact, it was difficult to shut Cowitz up. As the butlers refilled his cup, he rattled on, identifying the other parties of guests. House Glore had interests on worlds throughout the subsector, and regular banquets such as this oiled the wheels and kept things moving. Eventually, I managed to hand Cowitz off to Amos, the only man I knew capable of out-talking him. The two fell to complex discussion of the subsector balance of trade. I kept a close eye on the head table. Uricel Glore, a bloated, thick-set man in bejeweled ceremonial battle dress, was giving Gorgone Locke plenty of attention. I watched Uricel closely. There was something about the man, not the least that his wide, puffy face and slick, lacquered hair made his resemblance to portraits of his infamous ancestor Pontius uncanny. He drank unstintingly and laughed a wet, loose laugh at the shipmaster's jokes. His fat, powerful fingers constantly pulled at the braided collar of his uniform jacket to ease his wide neck. Lord Oberon was a taller, leaner man with generous, cliff-like cheekbones rising above a forked goatee. The familial characteristics of the Glore line were plain in his physiognomy, but he was more regal and distinguished, and lacked the dissolute languor of his younger sibling. Lord Glore spent the night chatting happily with his off-world cousin, a bumptious young cretin, with a whooping laugh and flamboyant courtly manners, but his real interest seemed to lie with the quiet ecclesiarch, Datso. I took note of the shipmaster, too. Gorgone Locke was a raw-boned giant with hooded, sunken eyes. He had long red hair, tied back and beaded, and his jutting chin was peppered with silver stubble. I wondered about his ship and his business. I would contact Maxilla and make inquiries. The banquet lasted until past midnight. As soon as was polite, we retired to our rooms. The Glores had given us a suite of rooms in the west wing. Outside, the wind had got up and was making plaintive sighs down the old chimney flues and open grates. Rain pattered against windows, and doors and shutters twitched and knocked in the draughts. Haldane was alone in the suite's sitting room when we came back. He had several data slates open for study on a table and looked up as we came in. "Well?" I asked him. He and Betancourt had run sweeps of the immediate wing whilst we had been dining. He showed me the results. Most of the rooms were spy-wired with vox thieves and a few picked sensors, and there was a complex infrastructure of alarm systems. Haldane had set up a small jammer to blind the spyware in our suite.
"Comparisons," he said,
showing me an overlay of two charts and a data slate.
"The green areas show the parts of the building my master gained access to during his visits."
Voke had been obliging enough to supply me with reports of his inspections.
"We can overlay in red the results of the sweeps your man and I have managed to make this evening."
There were considerable discrepancies. Voke may have opened every door he could find, but this showed me ghost areas that he had not gained access to because he hadn't known they were there. "These are cellars?" I asked.
"Underground rooms, certainly,"
said Haldane. He had a soft, sickly voice that seemed to seep from his slit-like mouth.
"Adjoining the wine vaults."
The drapes billowed in as an exterior window opened. Betancourt, his hooded black body glove wet with rain, climbed inside. He pulled off his grip gloves and boots and unstrapped his equipment harness. "What did you find?" Dripping and cold, he took a glass of spirits Beckwin brought him and showed me his scanner pad.
"The roof is lousy with alarms. I didn't dare probe too far, even with my jammers and sensors. There are rooms under the east wing that Inquisitor Voke didn't know about. A network of tunnels seems to link them to the west wing under the courtyard."
I spent a few more minutes running through the details and then went into my room to change. I put on a heat-insulated body glove of matte black plastic weave with a tight-fitting hood and supple gloves. Then I strapped a webbing harness around my torso and filled the integral pouches with a compact scope, a set of multi-keys, a folding knife, two spools of monofilament wire, a tubular torch, two jamming units, and a scanner pad. I secured my Vox unit's earpiece under my hood, buckled an auto-pistol into the rig strapped across my chest, dropped two spare clips into a thigh pouch, and finally placed my inquisitorial rosette in my hip pocket. This was an endeavor that risked discovery. The rosette would be my joker, to be played if it became necessary. I went back into the sitting room and laced on the grip gloves and grip boots that Betancourt had been using. "If I'm not back in an hour, you can start to worry," I told them. Outside, blackness, rain, and the assault of the wind. The outside wall of the great house was soaked and old, the lime wash crumbling in places. I had to test every move I made to make sure the overlapping teeth of the grip pads on my hands and feet were secure. I moved along the side of the house, feeling my way, until I was able to crouch on an outcrop of guttering. I taped Betancourt's data slate to my left forearm for easy reference. The tiny backlit screen showed a three-dimensional model of the building, and an inertial locator built into the slate moved the map and kept my current location centered. Over the downpour, I heard feet crunching gravel, two stories below. I clung to the bricks and tapped off the slate so that the screen glow wouldn't give me away. Two men from the house militia, huddled in foul weather capes, passed below me, lit by the windows on the ground floor. They took shelter in a doorway porch, and shortly after that I saw the flash of an igniter or match. Presently, the cloying odor of obscura drifted up to me. They were almost directly below my perch, and I didn't dare move until they were gone. I waited. My joints were going numb from the cold and from the hunched position I had been forced to adopt, simply to stay on the gutter. The rain grew still heavier, and the wind swished the invisible trees of the steep woods behind the house. I could hear the men chatting, an occasional laugh. This wouldn't do. I was losing time and the feeling in my legs. I focused, drew in a calming breath, and reached out with the will. I found their minds, two warm traces in the cold below me. They were soft and blurred, their responses undoubtedly slowed by the opiate effects of the obscura. Difficult minds to plant strong suggestions in, but vulnerable to paranoia. I drove in with the will, toying gently with their anxieties. Within seconds, they started from the cover of the porch, hissing animatedly at each other, and headed off at a trot across the yard. Relieved, I moved down the wall, bracing my weight against a jutting window ledge as I found footholds around a downpipe bracket. On the ground, I hugged the shadows of the west wing and moved down the yard. Betancourt's careful reconnaissance had shown up laser trips around the gatehouse, and others that extended from the edges of the border beds to the basin of a fountain in the yard. Though I could not see them, they were precisely marked on the slate, and I simply stepped over each in turn, all except the last, which ran at waist height, and which I ducked under. My goal was the launch hangars on the far side of the rear yard. The sweeps had shown up an access point to the cellar network there. Betancourt had located others, but they were all in private areas of the house, or in staff sections such as the scullery, the cold store, and the meat pantries. The shutter doors of the launch hangars were closed, and the lights off within. I gripped my way up the outside stone and up along the shallow tiled roof. At the summit of each hangar roof was a metal box vent designed to expel exhaust fumes. With my folding knife, I prized a louvered metal panel away and slid into the duct, feet first. The short metal funnel of the duct was open below me, and I looked down at the top of a parked launch. A short drop, and I was crouching on the back of the vehicle in the dim garage. I got off the craft and went around behind it. A small wall hatch led through into a servicing workshop, which then opened into a parts store. The ferrocrete floor was spotted with oil, and I had to move carefully in the dark to avoid knocking into obstructions such as lathes, tool trolleys, and dangling hoist chains. I checked the slate. The access way was at the rear of the parts store. This store was taking itself much more seriously. A tamper-proof ceramite seal, a tumbler alarm, and a keypad for entry codes. I sighed, though I hadn't expected this to be easy. I would need to tape a jammer to the latch to avoid tripping any alarm or access signal. Then it would be a job for the scanner to search and configure a usable code. 10 minutes' work if I was lucky. Hours if not. I pulled off my grip gloves so I could more easily manipulate the tools, and paused. An idea struck me. My mentor, the mighty Hapshant, had lacked psychic skills of his own, a dyed-in-the-wool mono-dominant, Emperor love him. But he had been a firm believer in gut instinct. He told me a servant of the Emperor could do worse than trust a flash of instinct. In his opinion, the Emperor himself placed such feelings there. I tapped the word De Sumner into the pad. The lock cycled, and the door opened. A clean, warm, well-ventilated staircase, significantly newer than the main structures of the estate, took me down into the cellar system. There was a caged lamp every 3 meters down the wall. By the chart and my estimation, I was some 10 meters underground, moving beneath the east wing. I removed my hood to hear better. De Sumner opened another hatch, and I entered a long hall with hatch doors along one side. One stood open, and I could hear voices and smell smoke. I edged along and skirted the hatch so I could peer in.
"Secured with 2 weeks," a voice was saying.
"Said that month ago," another snorted. "What's the matter? You're trying to inflate your fee?"
The room was some kind of lounge or study. Books and slates were racked with archive-like precision in wooden stacks along the walls. Soft light glowed from pendant lamps, and also from a number of sealed glass-topped caskets in front of the shelving. They reminded me of the protective controlled environment units Imperial libraries used to display especially ancient and valuable texts. The room was carpeted, and as I craned round, I could see 4 men sitting around a low table in throne-like armchairs. One had his back to me, but from the folds of his coat falling over the chair's arm, I was certain it was Uricel Glor. Facing him, sitting back in his chair, was the shipmaster, Gorgon Locke. The other two I didn't know, but I had a feeling they'd both been at the dinner. They all had glasses of liquor, and one of the unknown men was using a water pipe to inhale obscura. Various objects lay on the table between them, some wrapped in velvet, others unwrapped and displayed. They looked like stone tablets, old relics of some sort.
"I'm just trying to explain the delay, Glor," Locke said. "They're a difficult enough culture to deal with at the best of times."
"That's why we pay you," Glor said with a scoffing laugh.
He leaned forward and toyed with one of the tablets.
"But we won't stand much further delay. We've invested a great deal in this matter. Time, funds, resources. It's meant holding back or cancelling other enterprises, some of them very special to us."
"You will not be disappointed, Lord," said the man with the narco pipe.
He was dressed simply in black, a slightly built, bald individual with watery blue eyes.
"The archaeozenan provenance of these items speaks for itself. The Saruthi are serious about their offer."
Uricel started to reply and got to his feet. I ducked into cover and then moved away down the hall. Iclone's code opened the door at the end, and I crept through into a wide, circular vault. 2 more hatches of regular pattern led off to either side. Ahead of me was a larger archway, protected by a force screen instead of a door. I backed into hiding alongside this opening, as someone cancelled the force screen from inside. A figure stepped out, turning to raise the screen again. It was Cowitz. I took him from behind, an arm locked around his throat to silence him, another hand pinning his right arm. He gurgled and struggled. I twisted him round and slammed his head against the doorframe. Cowitz went limp. I dragged him in through the open force portal. A control on the inner wall raised the screen again. The chamber was long with a low ceiling. The climate-controlled air was dry. I realized it was a chapel of sorts, a stone-floored, rectangular nave leading to a shape that seemed to me an altar. The room was otherwise bare of features, even seats or pews. Light glowed from recessed lamps in the roof. Leaving Cowitz on the floor, I strode down the length of the chapel and took a closer look at the altar. It was 2 meters high, black, fashioned from a single piece of obsidian. The glassy stone seemed to glow with an internal light. On top of it was a jeweled prayer box about 30 centimeters square. I lifted the lid carefully with the blade of my knife tool. In a bed of velvet lay an intricate sphere. It looked like a jagged lump of quartz, the size of a clenched fist, inlaid with gold circuits and complex woven wires, like an oversized uncut gemstone in a bizarre, ornate setting. I spun around at a sound from behind me. Cowitz, blood dripping from his dented forehead, stood pointing a las pistol at me. His face was pale, angry, confused. "Step away from the Pontius, scum," he said. Chapter 11. Revelations. The Noble Sport. Pacification 505. This was no place to be trapped. I dug into my reserves of concentration, and without any physical movement, struck him clean between the eyes. A psychic goad like that, especially at close range and with a clear line of sight, should have felled him like a force hammer. Cowitz didn't even blink. "Don't make me repeat myself," he said, raising the weapon so it pointed at my head. The room was psychically shielded. It had to be. Either that or something was leeching psychic energies out of the very air. "There's been a misunderstanding, Cowitz," I said. "I went for a walk and must have taken a wrong turn." It was pretty lame, but I wanted to keep his responses engaged and his mind busy.
"I don't think so," he hissed.
He was groping behind himself with his free hand, trying to find the control panel for the entrance. There was an alarm stud on it. I waited. At any second he was going to glance round involuntarily to help his fumbling. When the gesture came, I threw myself forward and down, pulling my auto-pistol. He looked back with a cry and fired, but his aim was too high, and the shot flared off the end wall. From a prone stance, I punched 2 shots through his left collarbone and threw him back against the force door, which crackled at the impact. Cowitz collapsed face down on the floor, and blood began to pool around him. I reached the door control. An amber rune was flashing. The bastard had managed to press something. I hit the force door deactivator. Nothing. I punched Day Sumner into the keypad. Nothing. I realized I was in deep trouble. I guess the Cowitz had hit an alarm that locked everything out. That was what prevented me from opening the door. Uracel Glor and several of his house militia appeared outside the shimmering force door. I could see them peering in and shouting. I backed from the doorway and snatched up Cowitz's las pistol. When the door opened, I would use both guns to take down anything that tried to get in. Then something psychic, dark and monstrously powerful, rushed into my mind from somewhere behind me, and I blacked out. A face was looking down at me as I came round, a handsome face with blank eyes. The face started to say something. Then it combusted and melted away, and I realized it was just a dream. And I awoke properly into a world that was nothing but pain. "Enough! Don't kill him," said a voice. Another voice laughed, and a tremor of acute agony peeled through my forebrain, lungs, and gut.
"Enough," I said. "Lock!"
A mild, disappointed curse. The agony receded, and I was left with numbness and throbbing background pain. I was spread-eagled, my wrists and ankles bitten by the manacles that locked me to a massive hardwood cross. They'd taken my equipment, harness, hood, earpiece, and everything else, except the leggings of my body glove and my boots. What could only be dried blood caked my lips, mouth, chin, and throat, and fresh blood still drooled from my nose. I opened my eyes, A meaty fist was holding my inquisitorial rosette in front of my face.
"Recognize this, Eisenhorn?" I spat blood. "Thought you'd wile your way in among us, and then produce this crest and make us all cower in fear?"
Uricel Glor took the rosette away and peered down into my face.
"Doesn't work that way with the House of Glor. We're not afraid of your kind."
"Then you are very foolish indeed," I said.
He slammed my head back into the cross with an open-palmed blow to my forehead.
"You think your friends are going to help you? We've rounded them all up. They're just down the cell block yonder."
"I'm perfectly serious," I said. "Others know I'm here, and you really don't want to be messing with a servant of the Inquisition, no matter how much at your mercy you think he is."
Glor hunched down in front of me, his hands steepled.
"Don't worry. I don't underestimate the Inquisition. I'm just not afraid of it. Now, there are some questions I'd like answers to."
He got up and moved back. I saw the filthy stone of the cell chamber we were in, a double-locked hatch up in one corner at the head of a flight of stone steps. Lord Oberon Glor and the obscure pipe-smoker from the library room stood at the foot of the steps, watching intently. The shipmaster, Gorgone Locke, sat astride a dirty wooden bench nearby. He wore some strange apparatus on his right hand, a glove of segmented metal that ended each digit with a needle-like spike.
"You've got it wrong, Glor. It's you who will provide the answers."
Uricel Glor nodded to Locke, who got up and moved towards me, flexing the needle glove.
"This is a Strucine neural scourge. Our friend Mr. Locke is quite an expert in its application. We were delighted when he volunteered to run this interrogation."
Locke grabbed me by the throat with his bare hand, twisted my head up, and his glove fist disappeared out of my field of view below. A second later, and cold lances of pain threaded my lungs and heart, and my windpipe went into spasm. I began to choke.
"Educated man like you knows all about pressure points," Locke said conversationally. "So do the Strucy. But they like to do more than tap them. They like to burn them out. I studied with one of their sacred torturers for a year or so. This grip, for example, the one that's choking you. It's also paralyzing your respiratory system and stopping your heart."
I could barely hear him. Blood was drumming in my ears, and explosive light and color patterns were fogging my vision. He withdrew his glove. The pain and choking stopped.
"Just like that, I can stop your heart, burst your brain, blind you. So play along."
With all the strength I could muster, I smiled and told him his sister had particularly commended my lovemaking skills over his. The glove gripped my face, and needles lanced into my cheeks. I blacked out again for a moment.
"Haven't killed him,"
I heard Locke hiss as consciousness swam back. Dull pain oozed through my face.
"Look at him, look at him. Where's that cocksure smile now, you little bastard?"
I didn't answer. Locke leaned close, so his brow pressed against mine, and his eyes were all I could see.
"Needlework,"
he snarled, his foul, obscure-flavored breath swamping my gasping mouth.
"I just lanced a few points in your face. You'll never smile again."
I thought about telling him I didn't see a lot to smile about, but I didn't. Instead, I lunged forward and bit into his mouth. His scream, transmitted by our contact, shook my jaws. Blood spurted. Fists struck repeatedly and desperately against my skull and neck. His long red hair came loose, and the beaded ends whipped about my head. At last he tore away, roaring. I retched out a mouthful of blood and a good fleshy lump of his lower lip. His gloveless hand clamped around his torn mouth. Locke stumbled back, enraged, and then hurled himself at me. He kicked hard into my belly and hip and punched me in the cheek so forcefully it nearly snapped my spine apart. Then I felt the needle stab in between my ribs on my left side, and breathless agony enfolded me. Locke was screaming obscenities into my face. Once again, pain blacked me out. I came back in a rush of excruciating discomfort and gasping breath as Uricel wrenched Locke off me and threw him across the cell.
"I want him alive," Uricel bawled.
"Look what he did,"
Locke complained incoherently through blood and torn lips.
"You should have been more careful," said Oberon Glor, stepping forward.
He leaned down to study me, and I gazed back into his haughty, leonine face, bearded, powerful, commanding.
"He's halfway to death," Oberon said with annoyance.
I told you fools I wanted answers.
Ask me yourself, I gasped.
Lord Oberon raised his eyebrows and stared at me. What brought you to my house, Inquisitor?
The Pontius, I replied.
It was a gamble, and I wasn't hopeful, but there was always a chance that the very word might auto-slay them, as it had done Saemon Croats in the Sundome on Hubris. As I suspected, it didn't.
You came from Hubris? I stopped Eichlern's work there.
It was aborted anyway. Lord Oberon stepped back from me.
What is the Pontius?
I asked, trying and failing to focus my will. The pain in my body was overpowering.
If you don't know, I'm hardly going to tell you, said Oberon Glore.
He looked round at Uricel, Locke, and the pipe smoker.
I don't think he knows anything about the true matter, but I want to be certain. Can you be trusted to work efficiently, Locke?
Locke nodded. He approached me again, flexing the needle glove, and slid a needle into my head behind my ear. My skull went numb. It became almost impossible to concentrate.
My index needle is lancing right into your parieto-occipital sulcus,
Locke crooned in my ear,
directly influencing your truth center. You cannot lie, no matter what. What do you know of the true matter?
Nothing, I stammered. He jiggled the needle and pain ignited inside my head.
What is your name?
Gregor Eisenhorn.
Where are you born?
The Kears world.
Your first sexual conquest?
I was 16. A maid in the Skolem.
Your darkest fear?
The man with blank eyes.
I blurted out the last. All were true, all involuntary, but that last one surprised even me. Locke wasn't finished. He jiggled the needle and pierced the back of my neck with others so that my body went into paralysis and ice flowed down my veins.
What do you know of the true matter?
Nothing.
Without wanting to, I began to weep with the pain. Gorgon Locke continued to question me for 4 hours, 4 hours that I know about. Beyond those, I recall nothing.
I woke again and found myself lying on a cold rock-crete floor. Lingering pain and fatigue filled every atom of my being. I could barely move. At that time in my life, I had never felt such an extremity of pain and despair. I had never felt so close to death.
Lie still, Gregor. You're with friends.
That voice.
Amos.
I opened my eyes. Uber Amos, my trusted savant, looked down at me with a soulful expression even his augmetic eyes couldn't hide. He was bruised about the face, and his good robe was torn.
Lay still, old friend, he urged.
You know me, Amos,
I said, and slowly sat up. It was quite a task. Various muscle groups refused to work, and I came close to vomiting. I looked around blearily. I was lying on the floor of a circular rock-crete cell. There was a hatch on one side, and a cage-gated exit opposite it. Amos was crouched near me, and Elizabeth Beckwin, her gown ripped and dirty, hunched behind him, staring over at me with genuine concern. Away across the cell stood Haldane, arms folded, and behind him cowered the Guilda Marcellis and the 4 other Guild Synesius envoys who had escorted us. All of them looked pale and hollow-eyed, as if they had been weeping. There was no sign of Betancourt. Amos saw my look and said,
Aegis insubstantial, before the deluge.
In perfect glossier. Which meant Betancourt had somehow avoided the sweep that had incarcerated all my other companions. A tiny fragment of good news. I got up, mainly thanks to my determination and the support of Amos and Beckwin. I was still stripped down to my leggings and boots, and my torso, neck, arms, and head were washed in my own blood and stippled with bruised micropuncture wounds. Gorgon Locke had been thorough. Gorgon Locke would pay.
What do you know?
I asked them as my breath returned.
We're as good as dead,
Haldane said frankly.
No wonder my master leaves this kind of work to you, suicidal radicals. I just wish I hadn't agreed to join you.
Thank you for that, Haldane. Anyone else want to offer something less editorial? Amos smiled.
We're in a prison cell under the west wing, to the rear, almost under the woodlands. They burst into our quarters after you'd been gone 3 hours and seized us at gunpoint. I memorized a careful note of the route we were taking to this place, and have mentally compared it with Midas's map, so I am fairly sure of our location.
What the hell did they do to you?
Beckwin asked, dabbing at wounds on my chest with a strip of cloth torn from her gown. Wincing, I realized that that was why her gown was so shredded. She had been mopping my wounds while I was unconscious. A pile of torn and blood-soaked scads of material nearby stood testament to her devotion.
They came here an hour ago and tossed you in with us. They didn't say anything,
Haldane added.
Are you really an Inquisitor, Sire Farchival?
Mechelis asked, stepping forward.
Yes, I am. My name is Eisenhorn.
Mechelis began to sob, and his fellow envoys did the same.
We are dead. You have taken us to our deaths.
I felt some pity for them. Guild Synesius was rotten to the core, and these men were corrupt. But they were only in this predicament because I had duped them.
Shut up,
Haldane told them. He looked round at me and slid a tiny something from the cuff of his body glove. A small red capsule. What is it?
At Milodox, a 10-gram dose. You look like you need it.
I don't use drugs, I said. He pushed it into my hand.
At Milodox is a painkiller and a mind-clearer. I don't care if you do drugs or not. I want that in your system, if that gate opens.
I looked at the gate.
Why? Have you never been to a pit fight? He said.
The Glaws had got everything out of me they could. Now they wanted me dead. Me and my party. And that meant sport. The gate cranked open at what must have been dawn. Thin, grey light wafted in, and was almost immediately replaced by hard, bright, artificial luminescence. House Glaw militiamen in body armor burst into our cell and drove us out through the gate with force shields and psych whips. We were out in the open, blinking into the light, as the gate shut behind us. I gazed around. A vast circular amphitheater, enclosed by a dome high above, undoubtedly the golden dome we had seen on our approach. The floor of the pit was dank moss and earth, and lichen climbed the sheer sides of the 10-meter-high stone walls. Above the wall top, House Glaw and its guests sat in steep tiers, jeering down at us. I saw Uricel Glaw, Lord Oberon, Locke, Lady Fabrina, the Ecclesiarch Datso, the pipe-smoking man. Terence, the militia captain who had sat at our table during dinner, led an honor guard of nearly 40 men of the retinue. All wore green armor, plumed silver helmets, and all carried autoguns. More than 200 baying members of the Glaw clan, house staff, militia, and servants, made up the rest of the crowd in the theater. They'd been up all night, drinking and doing whatever other indulgence it took to turn them into hyperactive, bloodthirsty hyenas by first light. Ignoring the noise, I surveyed the compound. Breaks of trees sprouted at various places, and there were low outcrops of bare rock, giving the arena a sort of landscape. Nearby stood a rack of rusty weapons. Mechelis and his brethren had already rushed to it and taken blunt short swords and toothless lances. I went over and took a basket-hilted dagger and an oddly hooked scythe with a serrated inner blade. I weighed them in my hands. Haldane had taken a dagger and a long-hafted axe, Beckwin a wicker shield and a stabbing knife. Amos shrugged and took nothing. The jeering and booing welled around us. Then it hushed, and a chorus of gasps whispered from the auditorium. The Carnadon was 6 meters from nose to whipping tail. 900 kilos of muscle, sinew, striped pelt, and sawing tusks. It came out from behind one of the clumps of trees, trailing a line of heavy chain behind it from its spiked collar, accelerated into a pounce, and brought Mechelis down. Mechelis, envoy of Guild Synesius, screamed as he was destroyed. He screamed and shrieked far longer than seemed possible, given the spurting body parts the Carnadon was ripping away. It must have been my horrified imagination, but to me the screaming only stopped when he was a gnawed ribcage being shaken in the bloody moss by the vast predator. The other envoys screamed and ran. One fainted.
"We're dead,"
Haldane said again, raising his weapons. I swallowed the capsule he had given me. It didn't make me feel much better. its huge bared mouth running with blood and its chain jingling, the Carnadon turned on the other envoys. Beckwin shrieked. A second Carnadon sprang out of its trap towards us. It was slightly larger than the first, I noticed. It came right for me. I stumbled and dived to my right, and the feline dug its claws into the moss to arrest its pounce, overshooting and scrabbling round. Its trailing chain swished over my head. The creatures both made low, subsonic growls that shuddered in their cavernous throats and thumped the air. The larger beast swung around and made for me again, even as I regained my feet and leapt backwards. Haldane ran in from the side while its attention was on me and hacked into its flank with the blade of his axe. The Carnadon issued a strangulated hiss and lashed around, hurling Volksman across the arena, the clothing of his torso shredded by deep parallel claw marks. I jumped away and got a few of the twisted trees between it and myself. The first Carnadon had brought down another of the envoys. The shock of the impact and the crippling wounds simply silenced the man, and he uttered no sound as his limp body was thrashed and worried. The creatures were hungry. That much was evident from their prominent ribs. One factor in our favor, then. When the Carnadons brought down prey, they were primarily interested in consuming it. The long chains secured them to ground spikes next to their traps and allowed them free movement anywhere in the pit. Clearly the chains were measured carefully to prevent them leaping clear of the pit into the crowd. Tail slashing back and forth, the larger predator circled the edge of the arena bowl, its dark, deep-set eyes surveying the humans in range. Beckwin had dug herself and Amos into a corner, using her frail shield and a wall buttress as cover for them both, but the ruthless crowd were pelting them with coins and bottles and pieces of food to drive them out. They wanted sport. They wanted blood. The circling Carnadon, barking vapors of breath and spittle from its dripping snout, came round and began to accelerate towards Beckwin and Amos. Its pouncing mass alone would kill them, I was certain. I ran out from cover to intercept it side-on, and the crowd whooped and stamped. It faltered in its run-up as it became aware of me rushing it from the flank, and started to turn as I cut in with the scythe. The old hook planed matted fur from its shoulder blade and left a long red scratch down its ribs. It turned hard to face me. A paw lashed out, jabbing. I jumped back, swung again, hoping to at least hit the huge paw, for its reach was far longer than mine. Then it threw itself forward, a throbbing roar welling from its throat. I simply dropped on my back, stealing its chance to knock me down and shatter my bones. Then it was on me and over me, a paw crushing and slicing my chest, its head down, mouth open, reaching to bite off my face. Frantically, I thrust with my weapons, blind, and kicked up at its more vulnerable underside. The weight was off me abruptly. The Carnadon jerked away, making a terrible low moaning. My dagger was no longer in my hand. The pommel was jutting down out of the beast's chin. The blade transfixed its mouth, pinning it closed. It pawed and tore at the weapon, trying to dislodge it, shaking its massive head like a horse bothered by a fly. I got up. Blood ran from the fresh gashes on my chest. Haldane suddenly crossed my field of vision, his shredded tunic fluttering behind him. His axe came down square onto the great carnivore's back, cutting through the backbone with a loud crack. The Carnadon went into spasms, thrashing and clawing, rolling in the dirt. Haldane brought the axe down again and stove in its skull. The audience shook the pit with their howling. Missiles rained down on us. Haldane turned and looked at me with a murderous grin of triumph. Then the huge weight of the other Carnadon hit him from behind and flattened him face down into the arena floor. It had finished with the other envoys, all except the one who had fainted, who still lay where he had fallen. It tore into the helpless Haldane, ripping his scalp, rending the flesh off his back. With a guttural cry, I ran at it, caught it behind the ear with my scythe, and pulled. The curved blade hooked into the meat, and I succeeded in yanking its head back for a second. Then a well-aimed bottle struck me on the side of the head and knocked me over. I lost my grip on the scythe. The creature turned, leaving Haldane a mangled wreck, face down in the bloody soil. I scrambled back, kicking at it. "Eisenhorn!" Beckwin yelled, running forward on the other side. She threw her knife over the creature's back, and I caught it neatly. Disturbed by her cry, the beast swung about and lashed at her, tearing the wicker shield into hanks of raffia and knocking her down. I threw myself astride its back and thumped the dagger down repeatedly into its neck. The dagger barely seemed to bite into the thick hide. It writhed, trying to throw me off. I saw the scythe dangling from its scalp behind the ear, grabbed it, and hooked the blade under its spiked collar. The creature was frenzied now, pulling hard at its chain. I pushed the tooth of the dagger in through a link in the chain and down into its shoulder blade, then levered the weapon over with all the force I could muster. The link twisted open. The chain parted. The Carnadon ran forward a few paces, bellowed, and lunged. Effortlessly, it leapt up the side of the pit into the shrieking crowd. I was still attached to it by the scythe, the handle of which I clutched frantically. As we landed in the seating, I was thrown clear and crashed down onto the frantic fleeing audience. The beast was berserk. It tore into the crowd, hurling limp, mangled forms and gouts of blood into the air. The pandemonium shook the dome. I got up, pushing away the individuals who fell and stumbled into me in their efforts to escape. Gunfire ripped out across the amphitheatre. In the higher stands, I could see the militia scrambling down, firing at the Carnadon as Terence and other men hustled towards the safety of a side exit. The militia's shots were hitting people in the crowd. I jumped across the backs of several seats and punched aside two servants who grabbed at me. On the steps of the seating tiers just above me, two household guards ran down, raising their autoguns to shoot at the creature loose in the crowd. I felled one with a psychic lance, powered by rage and adrenaline, and snatched his weapon from his hands. Before his companion could turn, I had blown him down the steps and over the rail into the pit